It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now, we tread lightly here in this long-running debate about world-class Parmesan cheese from Wisconsin. The podcast Decoder Ring dares to ask that question: is a Wisconsin version more authentic than its beloved Italian counterpart? That is Parmigiano Reggiano, and that is from a particular region in Italy. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Mike Matuszewski is a Wisconsin master cheesemaker known for developing Sartori's Bellavitano, a Parmesan-like cheese. Mike, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning, and Willa Paskin here as well, writer and host of the Slate podcast, Decoder Ring. Willa, hi.
How are you?
I'm doing well. So let's talk a little bit about this episode on Parmesan and really looking at the authenticity. What made you want to compare these different cheeses and wade into this debate?
Yeah, so there is a really fun article in the Financial Times, the newspaper, the Financial Times, a couple months ago about Italian food myths. It was written by an Italian woman, and it interviewed this Italian scholar who lives in Italy and loves Italy, but also really thinks that Italians are very precious about a lot of things about their food. Italians are very precious about a lot of things about their delicious food. And one of the asides, or one of the sort of the paragraphs in the piece, this scholar sort of says, you know, if you want like Parmesan that tastes like what Parmesan tasted like in Italy 100 years ago, the stuff in Wisconsin is more authentic. It tastes more like what everyone was eating 100 years ago than the stuff coming out of Italy now. And that's just so counterintuitive and fun. And I needed to know more, basically.
And there begins your journey. And so you run into, or one of your sources is this food history professor, Alberto Grandi, who, you know, tells you that Wisconsin Parm tastes more like Parmesan made 100 years ago in Italy, and that's controversial. So what did you learn from Alberto?
So Alberto Grandi, he knows so much, and he was very gracious and fun, and he's also a bit of a rabble-rouser. I am like this too, but he's like a little contrarian, so he kind of likes... He's like a little, he used to be in politics. Like, he doesn't mind sort of tweaking people. So he sort of got us started because he sort of said this thing, and it was based on actually a lot of visual research that he's done, because frankly, none of us can taste cheese from 100 years ago, right? So it was based on sort of archival research about what Parmesan used to look like in movies and in advertisements, and sort of knowing the history of the consolidation of the industry in Italy, and also knowing a little bit about the story of how Parmesan had come to Wisconsin in the first place. So that was sort of our point of origin. Mm-hmm. And then actually we just like went really nuts, and it involves also speaking with Mike about how Parmesan came to Wisconsin in the first place.
I was going to say, well, speaking of nutty, but I'm talking about the cheese, really. No.
Oh, I'm very nutty.
So, and you love cheese history. So before you retired as a master cheesemaker in 2020, you were making Italian-style cheese for Sartori and Antico. How did working for a family-owned company founded by an Italian immigrant, how did that shape you as a master cheesemaker?
Let's see. How did that shape me? Well, it had some influence. When my history actually goes back to Kraft cheese, because that's the plant was established by Kraft in Antigo. Mm-hmm. And then the employees bought it in 1993, shortly after I joined the company, Kraft. So then for 13 years, it was Antigo employees. And then Sartori bought it in 2006. And it was a curiosity walking into, well, what do these people know and all this kind of stuff? And what is the heritage? And honestly, their Italianness wasn't that strong. I was really struck by that. But as they, you know, grew the company since then, it's just like their heritage has become more important. And when, you know, they started sharing the story of, you know, the founder, Paolo Sartori, he's a classic immigrant, but he wasn't a cheesemaker in Italy. He came to America, worked a bunch of different jobs, you know, made connections with Count Bolognese, who founded Stella Cheese, mm-hmm. and, you know, and then went off on their own. So again, it was, you know, I think it's natural for a culture to want to recreate their foods and all the other, the music, whatever that goes with that. So, you know, that Sartori was definitely doing when they started making cheese in 1939 in Plymouth. They were making mozzarella and provolone and Parmesan and Asiago. But again, you know, the taste change and what's better business to do. So eventually they became more into Parmesan and more into food service. But when they purchased the Anago Cheese Company, Anago had a very, very small retail business, about $250,000 in sales.
Mm-hmm.
And Sartori was interested in that aspect of the company. But it, you know, now it's like you're looking at, I can't even, it's in excess of $120 million worth of retail sales, I think, right now. Major growth. And it's, you know, it's just how to succeed in business without really trying is what I always, you know, tease everybody about. Somehow incredible cheese was formed and it got out the door and a lot of people did a lot of work to make it happen. And that was fun and interesting for sure.
That is part of the Wisconsin side of the story, as well as we talk about Italian and Wisconsin Parmesan. And we have retired Wisconsin cheesemaker Mike Matuszewski and Willa Paskin, who is a podcaster at Slate. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Willa, the economic side of the cheese, how does the commercial manufacturing of cheese in Italy and Wisconsin cause Parmesan cheese to diverge in taste and price?
Well, yeah, so Mike just alluded to sort of the story, but basically the story is this incredibly named man, Italian man named Count Bolognese, came to Wisconsin as a diplomat and started this cheese farm factory eventually in really high up in northern Wisconsin, close to the UP. And basically what happens in America, so that's starting like right around the 1920s. And after World War II, there's sort of, as soldiers are coming back, there's sort of like this boom in interest in foods from Europe. This is when the wine industry also starts to take off a little bit. And you actually, this is when Kraft starts to make their grated Parmesan for sale. So you start to see in America the spread of Parmesan, also sort of the rise of like Italian American food, sort of like red sauce places and pizza actually and frozen lasagna. And so Parmesan in America is actually changing. It's sort of becoming like less Italian and more just thought of as American food. And the taste is changing.
Shake
too,
it on,
right?
Shake it on to anything.
Exactly. Shake it on to anything. And also like, you know, the people that are eating it, we don't have, like Americans, most Americans don't have some frame of reference for what Parmesan is supposed to taste like, right? It could kind of taste like anything as long as it tastes good, or as long as it tastes good on pizza or pasta or whatever you're eating. So there's no kind of, there's no like establishing line, there's no base. So there's a lot of freedom to make it taste sort of however, good, bad, different. And that sort of happens. And meanwhile, in Italy, there sort of was a consortium formed in around Parma, the city of Parma, which is in Emilia Romagna, sort of in the north central part of the country, which is like a very affluent region in Italy. There's a big movement to sort of protect a lot of the specialty foods, including Parmesan. I mean, like prosciutto to Parma. There's tons of sort of protected foods that come out of Italy and France and all across Europe. So there's sort of this consolidation of how you're supposed to make Parmigiano Reggiano, which
there
had been made
traditionally. Yeah.
Right. And it had been made traditionally, like relatively traditionally for like hundreds of years. It's from the 13th and 14th century. That's when it first pops up. But you see it get like really regulated. Like you have to stick to those rules instead of just people sticking to those rules because that was the custom and the tradition. It's like it has to come out of this specific area and you have to make it in these certain ways. Like, you know, Mike knows all these rules way better than I do. But there's
European
a lot
says, yes.
Yeah. And like, and so that actually, of course, that also, you know, it sort of standardizes the quality, but it also locks it in a certain way. And there had been, you know, people were making Parmigiano Reggiano in a much sort of like in the late 1800s, the best Parmigiano Reggiano was actually coming out near Milan, not near Parma, you know, but they like sort of lock it into a certain area and they make the wheels slightly bigger, you know, not ton bigger, but because they're basically like, it's this, you know, they want to be able to sell more of it and ship more of it. And they, you know, they used to have sort of like this black rind that just sort of formed naturally. And they kind of actually start scraping that off so that they can, so they can actually market, because Parmigiano Reggiano is so expensive and such a gourmet product that it actually costs a lot of money. And so there's,
I thought that was really brilliant, kind of like, you know, proof that it's the real thing.
Yeah, because people steal Parmigiano Reggiano. Like, it's a, it's a, there's a black market in this cheese. Like, that's how expensive
Mike,
it is.
Mike, yeah. What do you make of that?
That's their branding power. It's actually quite genius. And again, they're not just competing with Parmesan that's made in Wisconsin, that's also in Germany, whatever. And then within Italy, there's a cheese called Grana Padano, which looks identical to Reggiano, and it can be made in a far greater geographic area. And it's a great cheese as well. And again, for, you know, the well, I'll call it a scheme that they came up with to regulate and market and ensure quality is a really, you know, for them, a really good idea. I did actually happen to talk to an individual who used to work for the consortium as one of the inspectors, and he goes, yeah, the cheesemakers don't always love them because, you know, there are rules. And, you know, things happen, and okay, if things aren't quite up to snuff, it's like you get, that cheese gets kicked out. And they're very rigid that way. But it does ensure the quality.
That is Mike Matuszewski. He is a Wisconsin Master Cheesemaker, mentor at UW-Madison Center for Dairy Research. We have Willa Paskin as well, digging into the distinction between Parmesan from Wisconsin and Parmigiano Reggiano that hails from Italy. You can ask a question, share a comment throughout the discussion, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Could Wisconsin Parmesan be more authentic than what you might get in Italy? We explore that question. It was posed in a recent episode of the podcast Dakota Ring. Writer Willa Paskin hosts it, went on a Parmesan fact-finding mission with an open mind. And we have Wisconsin Master Cheesemaker, known for his take on Parmesan. That is Mike Matuszewski. Also here, be part of the conversation. Call in with a question or thoughts on cheese, 800-642-1234. Willa, your podcast, you conducted a blind taste test of cheeses, including a trademark Parmigiano Reggiano from Italy and a Sartori Parmesan, which Alberto Grandi declared to be more authentic. How did that taste test go?
Yeah, sure. So we had like 8 cheeses, and a bunch of them were cheeses, like American-made Parmesans, including a Sartori that you could find in a grocery store.
Bunch of decoys in there.
Yeah, Grana Padano. There's also, Argentina has their own version of this. It's called the Reggianito, like their own Parmesan descendant. That was in there. So we tasted them all. I had never done a cheese tasting. It's kind of like fun. Just like I was doing it with this guy who's done a bunch of them. You like smell the cheese, you squeeze the cheese.
Squish it, right?
Yeah, totally. Like you see it, all of this, you listen to it even, you see if it squeaks a little bit, which you guys know about. I would say that part of the, there's a bias in a taste test like this, which is that I had mentioned earlier that there was a time and perhaps a lot of Americans didn't really have a baseline for what Parmigiano Reggiano or just Parmesan was supposed to taste like. But I don't know that that's so true anymore, because Parmigiano Reggiano, like the big gourmet wheels, are actually, you can find them in tons of places now. They're in lots of cheese stores.
Grocery stores.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Right. You know, you can get them like when you order your groceries on the internet, like all of those things. So we sort of have an idea of what it's like supposed to taste like. And, you know, people have different tastes and different palates, but I kind of want it to taste like what I was expecting it to taste like. So sort of to our mind, the classic, the Italian cheese won at tasting the most like what I think, you know, Parmesan supposed to taste like.
Mike, how do you think about that little taste test there? that your Parmesan didn't fare as good there.
So I'm going to say, yeah, I'm obviously disappointed, but not surprised. No, not at all. In particular, in that area, New York City area, the Northeast, they are very traditional in their taste. And it's been really difficult for any domestic Parmesan cheesemaker to get into that market. You know, we dealt with brokers over the years, and things like Parmesan or Asiago, they go, don't even bother. Our customers won't buy it. And again, you know, there is a difference in flavor. There is a difference in texture. And I'm not sure which Sartori Parmesan you sampled in this. There is the standard 10-month-old, and then there's the much more flavorful 20-month cheese that has the brand name Sarvecchio.
Yes, I ordered the Sarvecchio off the internet. I was really trying to get the real stuff. I think we had both, but I it was a Sarvecchio. Okay. I knew we were supposed to get that one.
and again, there are differences. And again, it's like it really comes down to people's preferences. And I'm not offended at all by that you preferred the Reggiano over anything else. And recently, we did a program at Center for Dairy Research to train a bunch of people in the cheese industry, specifically around hard Italian cheeses and what they are and the background for all of them. And in that tasting, there was like 20 odd people. They preferred Reggiano first and Sarvecchio was second.
Why though, Mike, why is sweetness in Parmesan important? Because sweetness kept coming up in that tasting.
Sweetness is important because as humans, we love sweet things. We really, really do.
Oh, the truth comes
Sour
out.
Generally turns us off, but it's also an indication that the cheese is broken down to a point where it's highly digestible. There's a long tradition, folklore, that if you're sick, Parmesan cheese is one of the best things to eat. They, you know, prescribe it for mothers who are nursing and things like that. You know, there's purported health benefits. And, you know, Sartori is one that will promote that. And, you know, just the industry in general promotes that because, again, it's so well aged. And it's actually, there's no lactose in the cheese because of its long aging process. So those who have a lactose intolerance, they can try it. And if they're cautious, they will find that it's just like, okay, if you're truly lactose intolerant, that won't bother you. You might have a dairy protein issue, but if it's just a pure lactose intolerance, you can generally eat Parmesan cheese all day long.
All day long. That is Wisconsin cheesemaker Mike Matuszewski. And we have Willa Paskin here, podcaster, as they looked into Italian and Wisconsin Parmesan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. So Willa, you know, one of the takeaways from your podcast episode was that, like, I just wrote down, seasons change, people change, foods are always changing.
Turn. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And, that's such an important takeaway. Like, the tools over 100 years ago, they're not the same as today, and the taste buds are different. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think what's interesting about that in the context of food in particular is that it's not, you know, it's like not just a cliche, because I think we really like to think food is so tied up in our traditions, right? And we really like to think that we can be traditional, that like we can pass recipes and foods down to our children, and our grandmothers and grandfathers can pass them down to us, and that, you know, things can sort of like, there can be some still center and we can taste what our ancestors tasted. And I think the truth is that like, that just isn't exactly true, which doesn't mean that the thing we're eating isn't beloved and meaningful and full of all this memory, but it's like, no, everything changes even if you think it's not. And that sort of, I mean, I think the story of Parmesan is like, I think in America, especially about a food like Parmesan, we're probably pretty comfortable with the idea that like American-made Parmesan has changed and is changing because its whole existence seems like, well, it was about change in the first place. I got to get here. But in Italy, I think it, where sort of a lot of this food stuff is much more tied up in sort of the idea of like, of things being locked in. It's like, I mean, and this is sort of Alberto Grandi's point in raising this whole rabbit hole about Parmesan is like, even when you think something is set in stone and it's been the way it is for 800 years, you view that is probably not the case.
Well, thank you both for joining us. This was so much fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
Willa Paskin. Yes, Mike. Willa Paskin, writer and host of the Slate podcast, Dakota Ring, Mike Matuszewski, retired award-winning master cheesemaker. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's a morning show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about family.
The connection between a grandmother and her granddaughter is special, especially when it's bound by braids. Writer Araceli Esparza tells us more about it in the story Braided Life or Vida de Trenzas.
Everyone, everywhere wears their hair differently, but not me. My braids, I wear them every day because I like it that way. I wear a braid like mi mama, and she wears her braid like her mama, my grandmother. Braids are familia, but some days with all of its twists and turns, I wish to lose or cut it short. Monday, lunes. Mama, why do we wear braids? Quetzali asks. Braids are who we are, mija. I wear braids. Abuelita wears braids. Braids are like family. We are family every day. I don't want to wear my braids anymore. I want to be like everyone else with short or curly hair and be me. Tuesday, martes. At school, I see wavy hair, corn-rolled hair, twisted hair, and even colored hair. I want to snap my trenzas away, but when I touch them, they remind me what Mama said. And I walk on. Wednesday, miércoles. In front of a mirror, I comb my hair up. Maybe like this. I tease it sideways or like this to make new hair and a new me. Thursday, jueves. Abuelita, when I go to the tienda, there's short, spiky, and long hair, but my trenzas are woven. At the dress shop, I see round, soft, fluffy hair, but my braids are pulled tight. At the fix-it store, I see slick and shiny hair, but my braids hang down. You're right, Quetzali. Everyone wears their hair differently, says Abuelita. Friday, viernes. Our hair connects us to where we work, who we are, and where we come from, Abuelita tells me on the way to the park. I run, but my braids make me slow to chase or too big to go under, and after a while, my braids are like two matted fighting cats. Saturday, sábado. Abuelita, the kids at school yanked on my trenzas, and sometimes my braids get in the way of having fun. Gently, she sits me up on the chair and begins to part my hair. I understand, Quetzali. Sometimes when people see trenzas, they wish to have one, and because they don't have one, they feel that teasing is the only way. Abuelita, if I cut my hair, will I still be familia? Ay, Quetzali, familia is familia, always. Remember, if you do cut your hair, it will grow back. Sunday, domingo. Sitting in the salon with pinned up hair, ready for my haircut, I see me without my long, strong hair, and I see me, lonely and plain. With a twirl, I stop her scissor hands, and I make my braids like propellers, and with a whoosh, I'm in the air. Zoom, zoom, between backyards and from playgrounds and rooftops, I see all these people with shiny, brown, braided hair like me. Looking royal and proud. My braids, I wear them every day because I like it that way.
Araceli Esparza is a writer based in Madison and host of the podcast Midwest Mujeres. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We dig into issues now that the State Department of Justice is working on with Attorney General Josh Call. You can be part of the conversation at any point by asking a question or sharing your comment. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Attorney General Josh Call, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. It's good to be back in the program.
Well, let's start with scams. You and other attorneys general have announced a new crackdown on scam phone calls. How is the operation different from previous efforts by state and federal consumer protection authorities to stop illegal telemarketing?
Over the past several years, we've worked on a number of multi-state actions to fight illegal robocalls. And first, I just want to say why it's so important that we do this. I think anybody with a cell phone is familiar with the volume of robocalls that we get and the amount of spam. And that's an annoyance to just about everybody. But in addition to being an annoyance, robocalls are often used to try to initiate scams. And because the volume of these robocalls is so high, if even a small percentage of those end up being successful in causing a scam to move forward, that's a lot of people's lives that are impacted who are victimized through this process. So the more that we can do to fight illegal robocalls, not only the less annoyance we'll see, but the fewer scams. And so among other things, we have urged companies to take action to put in place protections or to reduce the number of robocalls. But a couple of things are key, and this initiative highlights some of those things. One is just getting more information out to the public about robocalls and how to be prepared to identify them and not to fall victim to some of these scams. But the other thing is we're trying to target companies and individuals who are responsible for getting, in some cases, literally billions of calls sent out across the country. So the enforcement action that we're involved in involving one of these companies alleges that this company sent or transmitted more than 7.5 billion calls to telephone numbers on the Do Not Call registry between December of 2018 and January of 2023, and approximately 157 million of those calls were to numbers in Wisconsin. We're seeking to reduce the volume of these calls through these kinds of actions.
Do you think litigation and these lawsuits against companies like Avid Telecom, will that help stop this illegal business schemes from going on?
I think it's going to help reduce the number of calls that folks get. And that's part of the reason we're targeting these high volume callers. You know, as I just mentioned, when you're talking about billions of calls, you can't bring individual enforcement actions in every case. There just aren't the resources or the time to do it. But by targeting the companies responsible for these large volumes of illegal calls, our hope is to really reduce the volume overall. And then we also want to empower people by making sure that they know why these scams are happening, how many of them are out there, because the less successful these calls are in leading to scams that impact people's lives, the less interest there's going to be in engaging in those scams.
Turning now to opioid settlements, and if you could first just take stock, because there are multiple multi-state settlements, you know, with the opioid makers and the distributors and the pharmacies. Can you just talk a bit about the settlement money that is coming to Wisconsin now and in the future?
Absolutely. One of my priorities throughout the time I've been Attorney General has been to ensure that companies that engaged in illegal actions that contribute to the opioid epidemic are held accountable. This epidemic has devastated people's lives across the state and across the country. And as we have alleged, there were a lot of actions that were taken that contributed to the epidemic based on misrepresentations or failures of companies to step in when they knew that the volume of opioids being sold was indicative of problems going on. We sued Purdue Pharma, which declared bankruptcy. We've been part of multi-state investigations. My administration joined investigations into opioid distributors. And because of all of the actions that we've been involved in other states and local and municipal governments, we have now helped to secure hundreds of millions of dollars that are going to be going to communities across the state of Wisconsin to fight this epidemic. There was a very large settlement announced, I believe it was last year, involving some opioid distributors and a manufacturer that's going to result in over $400 million coming to the state of Wisconsin. More recently, there was an announcement of settlements with Teva, Allergan, CVS, and Walgreens. That's going to result in over $250 million additional dollars coming to the state of Wisconsin. So we're talking about well over half of $1 billion coming into the state over a long period of time. And my hope is that these dollars will go to fundamentally transforming our response to the epidemic, increasing access to treatment and recovery programs, as well as efforts to enforce the laws and to combat the epidemic, and then to prevent people from becoming addicted as well.
Should the State Department of Justice receive a portion of the settlement money for law enforcement purposes?
Well, we've declined, first of all, to take any portion of the settlements as attorney's fees for the Department of Justice. There's also specific legislation on this the opioid settlements in particular.
Mm-hmm.
The way that the funds are being allocated is that 70% is going to counties and municipalities that were involved in litigating, and 30% is going to the State Department of Health Services.
Mm-hmm.
So far, the vast majority of funds have been allocated to efforts to prevent prevent people from becoming addicted or from harm resulting from addiction, or to support recovery and treatment programs. And I think that's absolutely appropriate. Now, if some resources are directed towards enforcement efforts as well, I think that that's absolutely appropriate. And I think that's, we're going to see that, especially through some of the counties and local governments. But my goal is for these resources to be used as effectively as possible to fight the epidemic.
Attorney General Josh Call with us to talk about pressing issues in the State Justice Department. Join in the discussion. Your thoughts, ask a question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Attorney General Josh Call on a range of issues involving work at the State Department of Justice. You can field your question to the Attorney General. Share what's on your mind. The number to be part of the discussion is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Your counterpart, a state over, Michigan's Democratic Attorney General Dana Nessel, announces felony charges against 16 Republicans who acted as fake electors for then-President Donald Trump in 2020. What is your reaction to these charges?
Can't comment on the specifics involving the state of Wisconsin. We generally don't confirm or deny the existence of investigations. But I can say a few things generally. One is, on the day of the insurrection, one of the things I commented was that we appeared to be seeing a seditious conspiracy happening, and that it was vital that those responsible be held accountable. And that remains my view to this day. If people committed crimes in order to try to subvert the results of an election, it's critical that the people who committed those crimes are held accountable. Having seen some of the public statements from AG Nessel prior to these charges being filed, I think it's not surprising that they were. Also, there's been a lot of attention on, there's an ongoing federal investigation into the events of the insurrection and potentially related actions. And I think it's really critical that those efforts continue to move forward and that those who did commit seditious conspiracy or other crimes to try to overturn the result of the election are held accountable.
That's what I'm kind of wondering. I mean, do next steps on fake electors, does it hinge on where the investigation goes by the U.S. Justice Department into the 2020 election? I mean, we've seen Wisconsinites in elections system, testifying.
Yeah, well, again, I can't comment specifically on mm-hmm. what the Wisconsin Department of Justice is or would be doing. But what I can say is the approach that we take at the Department of Justice to the enforcement of our laws, whether in this context or any other context, is pretty simple at a fundamental level, which is we consider the facts and we consider what the law is, and we approach the case based on those two things. And then our judgment as to how we can most effectively ensure that the laws are enforced and that people are held accountable when that's justified based on the facts and the law. And that's how we approach any enforcement matter, and the same basic logic applies here as well.
We're going to turn now to the Office of School Safety. The Republican-controlled state legislature rejected renewed funding for Office of School Safety, but the office recently announced its 24/7 confidential tip line is now able to receive text messages. How does the office plan to operate without state funding?
Well, that's a great question. You know, ultimately, we're going to need state funding to ensure that office can continue operating in the long run. I think it's important to note where we are with that office. It was launched in 2018. It was created with bipartisan support, and the legislation creating it was signed into law by Governor Walker. And over the past 5 years, that office has been a huge success. It's launched innovative and effective programs to help keep kids safe in our schools. And one of them is the program you just mentioned. It's a 24/7 tip line that anybody associated with a school can contact to report concerns or to get school safety guidance. And that tip line has received thousands of contacts from around the state of Wisconsin. That includes over 100 tips involving concerns about potential school attacks. And you know, while certainly not all of those cases would have ultimately resulted in an attack going forward, if in just one or two cases we've been able to get an intervention to happen that helps keep kids safe and that prevents an attack on our schools, this program has been a huge, huge success. We have relied on federal grant programs and then federal COVID relief funding to keep this program, to launch it and then to keep it going. But we're at a point now where we need the state through the state legislature to step in. We are looking at ways that we can try to extend the funding so that this office can continue operating. But ultimately, for the office to continue doing the work that it's doing, we're going to need the legislature to step up. So it's my hope that we will see legislators pursue standalone legislation that will fund this office. But it was certainly a disappointment that the budget didn't provide the kinds of resources we need to keep programs from being gutted at that office.
I wonder, without all the resources from the Office of School Safety, is there a new burden on schools to do more to stop threats and do their own crisis prevention and response?
There will be, and we would be leaving schools to fend for themselves on issues that having a centralized hub that provides best practice guidance is really critical. Just to give you an example, the tip line I mentioned, in some cases, school districts have used to replace a private company that they used. I was told that in the Kenosha School District, for example, the district saved about $17,000 a year by switching over to our program, the Speak Up, Speak Out program. Schools, without the Office of School Safety being fully funded, will need to make decisions about whether they're going to invest in private services like that, which means dollars coming out of their budgets that otherwise would be going towards the other critical work that they're doing. Some schools may decide to go without having a tip line, and that leaves school officials without the kind of information they're able to get to help keep kids safe that we've had. And they would lose a center that helps collect best practice information and can send that to schools around the state. You know, our teachers are trained to teach our kids. That's what their background is in. It's not in being safety officials. And while schools do incredible work to help keep our kids safe, and some districts have school safety coordinators, having a centralized office that can do that research, that's trusted and can get it to schools around the state, helps ensure that kids across the state of Wisconsin are benefiting from best practices and from all the best information out there as we work to keep our kids safe.
We're catching up on a range of issues with Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call, leads the State Department of Justice. You can join in with your question at 800-642-1234. Landing on PFAS here, your agency has filed a bunch of lawsuits against PFAS makers and companies that have polluted. What is the status of these lawsuits?
Those cases continue to make their way through the court system. The two sort of major cases that we've filed on PFAS, one involves water contamination in the Marinette area, mm-hmm. Where we filed suit against Johnson Controls and against Tyco. The other case is a much larger suit that was brought against PFAS manufacturers and marketers and sellers, alleging, among other things, that there was not full information provided to the public about the dangers of PFAS. Those cases are both very significant ones. They're extensive, and they will involve extensive court filings and discovery. So those cases are going to take quite a bit of time. But what I could tell you is that we are committed to ensuring that the companies that have broke the law are held accountable, because every Wisconsinite should have access to safe and clean drinking water. And the companies that are responsible for contaminating the water should be the ones to pay to clean it up, not Wisconsin taxpayers.
Attorney General Josh Call, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Josh Call is Wisconsin's 45th Attorney General, is in his second term. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.